and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin!
Kamala Harris holds her first rally since announcing her bid for president. That and more in tonight's Spotlight Politics. And one-on-one with, wait, don't tell me, Peter Sagal, ahead of his one-night-only event. And now to some of today's top stories. The head of the U.S. Secret Service is stepping down. Director Kimberly Cheadle's resignation comes a day after a contentious hearing on Capitol Hill and amid bipartisan calls for her to step down in the wake of the assassination attempt of Donald Trump. The agency is facing criticism over how the shooter was able to get access to the rooftop and why the threat of a shooter wasn't communicated sooner. The move comes as the agency is tasked with security for the upcoming Democratic National Convention in Chicago. The city of Chicago is expanding its lawsuit against gunmaker Glock Incorporated. City attorneys filed their complaint in Cook County courts yesterday, adding the Austria-based parent company of Glock Incorporated, along with Eagle Sports Range in Oak Forest and Midwest Sporting Goods in Lyons, to the list of defendants. The city of Chicago claims the weapon endangers the health and safety of residents by making and selling guns that can easily be converted into fully automatic weapons with a cheap, small device commonly known as a Glock switch. The city claims the two dealers named in the suit are major suppliers of guns recovered in Chicago crimes. Nearly 200 former juvenile detainees say they were sexually abused inside Cook County Detention Center. In a lawsuit filed this week, the plaintiffs allege they were sexually abused by adult staff members and threatened to remain silent. The lawsuit goes on to say the alleged abuse at the facility has been going on since the mid-90s.
Adults at the detention center didn't care about a delinquent like me. Three staff members took advantage of my fear and confusion and sexually abused me. It's not something that I like to talk about or even think about. I did what I had to do to survive in there. But the act that those staff members forced me to do still give me nightmares.
To those who went through what I did, I want to tell you to stay strong. For those people around who care about you and will fight for you, I won't let our past dictate the rest of your lives. And we will make sure this doesn't happen to anyone else again.
In the complaint, plaintiffs say they were given food, cigarettes, more desirable chores, or in one case, even marijuana and alcohol in exchange for sexual favors or for keeping quiet about the abuse. We reached out to the offices of the Cook County Chief Judge and the Cook County Board President, but they said they could not comment on pending litigation. Neighbors around the United Center could be seeing a lot of activity, and it's not just because of the Democratic National Convention in a few weeks. The Reinsdorf and Wirtz families, which co-own the arena, are planning a $7 billion redevelopment of the space around the United Center. They're calling it the 1901 Project, a mixed-use development that includes housing, retail, entertainment, and public open space on the 55 acres of privately owned land surrounding the arena. The first phase of the project aims to start construction in the spring of 2025 on what is currently surface parking lots. Up next, our Spotlight Politics team on what to expect at the Democratic National Convention right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Kamala Harris kicks off her presidential campaign in the battleground state of Wisconsin. Meanwhile, her endorsements keep rolling in from Illinois politicians and across the nation. And city council grows concerned after Texas Governor Greg Abbott's promises at the Republican National Convention to keep sending migrants north. Here with all that and more is our Spotlight Politics team, Heather Sharone and Nick Blumberg. Amanda Vinicky is off tonight, but we've got you two here. And we're going to start off by listening to something that Governor Greg Abbott said last week at the RNC that alarmed Chicago officials.
I began busing illegal immigrants to Washington, D.C. And we have continued busing migrants to sanctuary cities across the entire country. And those buses will continue to roll until we finally secure our border.
Buses will continue to roll. Heather, are city officials worried about the prospect of a new wave of migrants being sent to Chicago just in time for the convention?
So for more than a year, city officials have been warning that Texas Governor Greg Abbott was going to capitalize on the city's spotlight during the Democratic National Convention. And they say that that renewed promise made them sound the alarm internally. And they are hyper prepared to cope with any renewed surge of migrants to Chicago, although there are fewer migrants in Chicago shelters really than at any time since the crisis began. This sort of fear short-circuited a discussion today about whether the city should be evicting migrants after 60 days. Is in city shelters. They say, look, yes, we have 5,000 empty beds, so that might not seem to make sense that we're evicting people, but we've got to keep that capacity in case we do see a big surge. At the peak of the crisis, 2,000 people per week were making their way to Chicago from the southern border. That would be very hard for the city to handle.
A surge has been something that the city has been concerned about for some time. Heather, how's the city preparing for the possibility?
Well, state, city, and county officials say they are all on the same page and they are prepared to expand that shelter capacity to more than 15,000 beds, which was what was operating at the beginning of the year. So that is very different than sort of what's happening now when there are fewer than 5,700 migrants in city shelters. But that is going to cost a lot of money. And it is not clear if that surge happens and they ramp back up to that 15,000 capacity, whether the city will have enough money to make it to the end of the year. And I don't know if you've noticed, it's been very controversial to get additional money from Chicago taxpayers to fund this care.
It has. Okay, so shifting a little bit to national, Kamala Harris kicking off her presidential campaign in Milwaukee today. So far, it looks like Illinois Democratic politicians are all on board. Nick, are there any state Democrats who are holding back?
There's not really any major figures who we're waiting to hear from. You know, we've heard from the entire Illinois congressional delegation. We've heard from the leaders of the Illinois House and Senate. We've heard from statewide elected officials like Attorney General Kwame Raoul. You know, I think the big one that maybe we haven't heard from, if we still are considering him an Illinois politician, is former President Barack Obama, who came out with a statement of praise for, you know, President Joe Biden's decision to step aside from the race, but who has yet to come out and endorse, Vice President Harris. There's a fair amount of speculation from political watchers that the idea here is, well, if he waits a couple days to come out and endorse, that creates another positive news cycle for the now Harris for President campaign. But certainly, you know, Governor J.B. Pritzker, we've heard from, he didn't endorse until Monday. And then when he made the call, the Democratic Party of Illinois also got on board and came out endorsing Harris. So really, we have seen a broad base of support for her since she was endorsed by Biden as his successor in this race.
Yeah. It took about 30 hours for her to consolidate enough delegates to win the nomination in what is likely to be a virtual roll call in the first week of August, so before the Democratic National Convention start. I also think it's possible that the former president is waiting for President Biden to address the nation tomorrow and sort of say his farewell to sort of electoral politics before weighing in. We know there's been a lot of tension between the Biden camp and the Obama camp, and I imagine the former president doesn't want to step on any more toes.
And of course, Nick, you mentioned J.B. Pritzker and his endorsement on Monday. Of course, there's been some reporting today as well. He says that he has not received a vetting packet from Kamala Harris's team just yet, as far as the short list, the beep stakes, as we like to call it in our line of work. And Democrats did reaffirm last night that virtual nomination will be happening before August 7th, and that's because of an issue on the Ohio ballot. Nick, does that close the door to any chance of an open nomination at the convention?
Unless there is something that gets completely upended, at this point, it looks like it is going to be Kamala Harris, who is the Democratic nominee for president. There really aren't any, you know, serious pathways forward unless something absolutely unexpected happens. Although certainly we have seen quite a bit of upheaval in this race just in the last few days. But, you you know, the way things have been going, you know, Kamala Harris moved very quickly to lock things up. Reporting was she spent about 10 hours on the phone on Sunday alone, making calls, you know, shoring up support. And just about anybody who would be a serious challenger to her is part of the Veep stakes or has endorsed her. So, you know, folks are really getting on board with this nomination. I think a lot of people see this as the clearest and cleanest path forward to prevent Donald Trump from returning to the presidency. And they want to make sure that they are, you know, on the right side of this for, you know, for their legacy as a Democrat.
I imagine some of that time on the phone was probably dialing for dollars, because she has also set what I believe to be a fundraising record with a massive amount, something, what is it, $80 million being raised on Sunday?
And growing, yeah. And I think a lot of that, too, you know, there was concern from, you know, some a lot of that $80 million was small dollar, you know, was grassroots. There was also concern about big money donors that were backing off and saying, we're not going to be opening up our checkbooks. We're not going to be hosting these events because they had such grave concerns about Joe Biden's candidacy. Now that that is no longer an issue, it seems that the cash spigot has been turned back on.
And the bucks are flowing.
We've also seen reporting from the Harris campaign that she's signed up tens of thousands of new volunteers. We also saw a little bit of that rally from earlier today in Wisconsin, where she was enthusiastically greeted by the crowd. And perhaps we saw the first signs of a campaign slogan. The crowd sort of on its own started chanting, we're not going back, which I think sort of encapsulates sort of what she thinks the stakes of this election are. It also dovetails with what I am sure is going to be a robust message about abortion care and reproductive rights, as well as sort of a focus on the future of democracy.
And then it mirrors some of what we heard from protesters at the RNC, including folks who are in town from out of Chicago, you know, pushing back against some of the GOP's policy positions. We're not going back was a part of that theme. So I think there is a very good chance we hear that, hear those words quite a bit more.
Yes, especially heading towards the convention. So yesterday, Secret Service Director Kimberly Cheadle grilled by House lawmakers about that July 13th assassination attempt on Donald Trump. Today, she resigned after resisting it for the last couple of weeks. Nick, do you think this is raising concerns about security for the DNC next month?
Well, we've already heard a lot since the, you know, assassination attempt on, you know, Donald Trump, that they were reevaluating all of their security procedures for the DNC. We've heard from, you know, the CPD about what they're planning to do, that they've been taking another look at this, that they will have outside support from police officers from other jurisdictions who are going to be here. Certainly, this is a huge concern for DNC organizers, for all the law enforcement agencies involved. But they did, you know, make a pretty proactive effort to get out front and say, we are taking this seriously. This is something we're looking closely at. It's also very different, you know, a campaign rally versus a political convention where you're going to have tens and tens and tens of thousands of people attending, you know, and in the area as well. So certainly it was going to get a ton of attention already.
So getting a little bit closer to home, staying at home, obviously, because Chicago is making headlines again with this historic lawsuit against gun manufacturer Glock. Heather, you're reporting on this today. The city expanded its lawsuit just yesterday. Why or who are the three new defendants and why are they being added?
Well, it's the parent company of Glock, which is an Austrian firm, as well as two Suburban gun shops, which the city says are the most irresponsible gun shops in the nation, and that they say the city can trace a number of guns used in crimes in Chicago to these gun shops. And they both sort of sell Glocks, and they sell sort of what's called the Glock Sear that turns it into essentially a homemade automatic weapon. Now, this is a significant test of the 2023 law signed by Governor J.B. Pritzker in the wake of the Highland Park 4th of July massacre. And this is really designed to give state officials a way of holding gun manufacturers accountable, which is a dicey part of federal law. And what's the issue here is that this original lawsuit filed in March got moved to federal court, where the city is going to have a much harder time making this case because federal law protects gun manufacturers in most cases. This lawsuit was refiled in Cook County. That's where the city wants this lawsuit to be. That's why the gun shops were allowed or added to this lawsuit in part. So we'll have to see if this attempt fares a little bit better than the last attempt to stay out of the federal courts.
Be interesting to watch. Okay, so Nick, body camera footage of a fatal police shooting in Springfield. The footage was released yesterday. The Springfield resident is Sonia Massey, 36-year-old woman. Does the footage that we saw, that body cam footage, does it shed more light on this tragedy, and what more do we know?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly gives much more clear details about, you know, her last minutes. You know, seeing the officers enter her home, she's clearly in sort of a confused state, making comments that don't necessarily, you know, make a great deal of sense. You know, you can see her in the kitchen. You know, there was a pot of water that she was reaching for. But it does make very clear just how quickly this escalated. But certainly, you know, in the response to this, unfortunately, another shooting where a black person has lost their life to a police officer, I think you've seen the response from people in positions of power very clearly trying to react, you know, not make a rush to decision, but not to drag their feet, because I think, unfortunately, we have seen many times before that these sorts of things get swept under the rug. They acted very quickly to, you know, make sure there was an indictment, there was the release of footage. What happens next is obviously in the hands of the courts.
Of course, and we're going to have more on this tomorrow on Chicago Tonight Black Voices as well. But for now, my thanks to our Spotlight team, Heather Sharoon, Nick Blumberg. Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Peter Sagal. With the news of the day can be tough, but for 26 years, Peter Sagal has been making it fun for audiences across the country as host of NPR's weekly radio show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. This week, he's offering fans a look behind the curtain, sharing takeaways from his memorable journey. And joining us now is writer and host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Peter Sagal. Welcome back. Good to see you.
It's a pleasure to be back.
Thanks for joining us.
You've changed the place since the last time
I was
here.
A little bit of redecorating.
Yeah.
Glad you noticed.
Very nice.
Thank you.
What happened to all the tchotchkes here in Chicago tonight?
Oh, some people are very sad about the tchotchkes.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll tell you about those later.
I'm in school tchotchke. I
may or may not have a couple of them in my office.
Uh-huh.
Let's talk about you.
Yes, please.
How did Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me come to be in front of a live studio audience?
It came to be in front of a live studio audience because it was such a stupid thing not to do it in front of a live studio audience that even we eventually figured that out. The show was launched, as you said, 26 years ago, which is incredible. I looked pretty much the same as I do now. In WBEZ in their studios, and the notion was, you know, we'd do it remotely. This was sort of pre-Zoom, if you will. And the idea was I would be, as the host in Chicago, our panelist, Paula Poundstone, in Los Angeles, Adam Felber in New York, Roy Blunt Jr., wherever he was. And here's the thing. If you have people in front of you, like audience members, just, and you say something funny, they might laugh. And if there are people there who might laugh, then the comedians and myself might actually try harder to be funny. It's an incentive system. So eventually we figured that out and started doing it live every week starting, I believe, in early 2005. And I got to tell you, when we had to go back during the Zoom, it was terrible. It was like having to move back into your childhood home after a lifetime of thinking you were getting away. And it still was kind of, you know, I didn't want the Power Rangers posters anymore. I'd grown beyond that.
Well, I think we all moved on,
yes.
Or not moved on, but
yes.
Like we all grew into different people. So listening to the show, obviously, like everyone is quick and funny and witty, and you really have to kind of be on your toes
Timing.
To keep up with your
Sorry.
Panelists.
Never mind. comedy joke. Yes.
Do you? I mean, obviously you prepare for the show all week, just as everybody does, but how often, you know, live radio, you've got funny people over here and you've got panelists calling in. Do you just kind of abandon script?
Oh, all the time. Absolutely all the time. I recommend it in case you've got, you know, if you're tired of that nonsense.
Nope. Sticking
just
to the script.
Chuck it. No, so my colleagues and I with whom I work, we prepare a script, we research stories, we find the sillier stories in the news, we think about them, we write jokes about them, we try them out, we have a very writer's room vibe. And so when I go in front of the audience, and we're never live, thank you, gods of broadcasting.
Unlike right here,
I know,
right now.
I mean, I was about to say, I am terrible on live TV, I don't know what we're doing here. God knows what is going to come out of this mouth. But the point of the story is that when we tape our show, I've got that script, but you're right, we've got these panelists. They're nuts. That's why we hired them.
They're nuts.
And so they're, I mean, it's like, you know, it's like preparing on a road trip and you've mapped out the destination and then you decide to share the wheel with four people who have no idea where you're supposed to be going.
And they're not looking at the map.
No, they're not. And so if they all of a sudden go left, say, and into a ditch, which is more likely than going right, this is NPR, then chances are my job is just to go with them because I can't jump out of the car. And that actually, that was really an extended metaphor, wasn't it? And,
but it's,
and it was okay.
But it's a lesson learned. I think it worked. Okay, I mean, and if it doesn't, we can just edit it out in post.
Right, exactly.
Obviously.
And then the people who will never see it on tape will never know about it. But the point of the story is, yes, and I think part of our show's appeal in an era where a lot of people are doing what we're doing really, really well, like John Oliver and Stephen Colbert and the late night hosts, all these people who are like doing amazingly, wonderfully produced, sharp comedy and satire. We're just kind of making it up as we go along, ultimately. And that has some appeal, as long as you can edit out the dumb stuff, which is why we don't do it live.
The show is a news quiz.
It is?
Right? Fewer and fewer people are consuming news. We ought to know that, but we're working on that. How do you keep the news fun and interesting in this day and age of, fake news?
I know. Well, we kind of have a news strategy. We kind of ignore, for the most part, all the major news, the depressing stuff, the serious stuff, and just do the fart news, pretty much. We cover farts in all, eliminations, process of excretory things very well.
No, spit,
I mean, yes,
vomit,
oh yeah. Well, we've done a fair number of that. Yes, basically any bodily fluid, that's our beat. It's getting a little gross. No, the point of that, what people like about us is, and I, to be serious for a minute, is we're the news that won't depress you. We're the news that will amuse you. We're the news that might, make you wonder about the vast breadth of the human experience. And when we do talk about the serious news, which we do, I mean, we'll be talking, for example, on this week's show about the new apparent Democratic candidate, Kamala Harris. When we do talk about things like that, what our motto is, we say the things on the radio that most people are reduced to shouting at the radio. So your wonderful reporters, for example, you just had on the show, probably think things but cannot say things because they are serious reporters. We are not.
And thankfully, you can say
we
what you
can
think.
Say them. And I think that's part of the appeal as well, that we're sort of NPR's unleashed id. Which looks like me.
Kind of like an anger translator.
Yeah, no, in a weird way. And the fact, I'm thinking like of the movie Inside Out, right?
You know,
where they have, which I, by the way, I was in, a little cameo in the first one.
Oh, yes.
But if you think like, if NPR had a brain and I was like its anger, it would look like me, don't you think? Kind of.
I get it.
Kind of
NPR is
small
angry
and bald. That's basically
tracks. I get it. So you're going to be having some conversations, or a conversation in particular in Chicago this week. You've done a few others around the country.
I have. I've been going around the country. It occurred to me that at the time when I thought of this, 25 years, quarter century, of doing this job, which by the way I never expected to do. Be careful. You may never leave that chair. I discovered that I had been sort of watching the world through this very strange lens, and I might have picked up some stuff along the way because I've got perspective, right? Mm. So I'm trying to use that perspective and coming up with sort of, for lack of a better word, words of wisdom or at least amusing observation about everything that I have seen. And I have terrifyingly seen a lot. We started with the Bill Clinton's Lewinsky scandal. We need a better name for that. It really wasn't her fault. It wasn't her fault. But that scandal, that's when we started. And, you know, there are people who were born after that, who are adults and drinking adult beverages and paying rent. I mean, we've been here for a while.
I don't know who those children are.
I know.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to come back to that. So you talked about this a little bit, hosting the show since it was created 26 years ago.
Yes.
And you weren't quite sure, but did you ever suspect it would last this long?
Never, not for a minute. I had a lot of ambitions when I was a young person, as young people tend to do. I was a playwright and screenwriter, so I was imagining I would be the first person to win not just the Oscar, Emmy, Tony, and Grammy, but also a Nobel. I'd be the I'd be the NIGOT, right? That was my ambition when I was a kid, or even older than a kid. And when this wonderful job at NPR, which I'd always loved, NPR was a listener for many, many years, came up, I assumed, well, this will be a nice little stop, and then I'll continue to move on and get to work on one of those letters. And instead I'm here, which sometimes is a little strange and surprising. But one of the things that's been very, I'll say, gratifying over the last few years is because we've been doing it so long, those young people who I mentioned, they grew up with us. I've been a part of their lives, which is flattering. Sometimes I've been a part of their family relationships. A lot of, say, women in their 20s bring their dad, who's in their 60s, and he says, well, we used to listen to this when we went to soccer practice. It was our bonding thing, and now I'm taking him here. And that's fabulous. So I never thought I would ever be a public radio institution. And yet, that's what the door, that's what it says on my dressing room door.
Public radio institution.
Enduring public radio institution.
Enduring Public Radio Institution, everybody. Peter Sagal.
Thank you, yes.
Thank you so much for joining us.
My
we appreciate
pleasure.
It. It's a real treat to talk to you.
Thank you.
And, of course, you can catch Peter Sagal's event at the Athenaeum Center on July 27th.
July 27th, this Saturday, 7 p.m.
Saturday. Get your tickets, folks. And that is our show for this Tuesday night. Don't forget to stay connected with us by signing up for our daily briefing. And you can get Chicago Tonight streamed on Facebook, YouTube, and our website, WTTW.com/news. You can also get the show via podcast and the PBS video app. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Calls for justice in the fatal shooting of Sonya Massie as a downstate police officer is charged with her death. And reaction to Kamala Harris's historic bid to become president. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm dedicated to preserving the dignity and rights of all individuals.